Hello, and welcome to our program, Reading of the ARP Magazine, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Kevin Altamirano, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from the ARP Magazine here on OWL Radio. Our first article for today is entitled, Tyler Perry is Flying High and Enjoying the View. The actor-producer has parlayed his comic character, Medea, into a stratospheric career as the billionaire head of a studio empire. And this is written by Harriet Cole of ARP. And this is done in a interview fashion. So questions are printed, and then the response by Tyler Perry is also printed. And I will read both parts. Question. Your success began with black audiences who packed Chitlin Circuit theaters in the 2000s to see your touring plays. Why did you choose that route instead of striking out for Broadway or Hollywood? I grew up in Louisiana, and my mother grew up in the Jim Crow South. She didn't have a healthy trust of white people. Because of the things she had endured, horrific things, she wanted me to know the value I had within me. I never felt like I needed to look outside of my own race for success. I knew that if I mined what was in our community, what I had in me, it would work. Question. You've talked about growing up with an abusive alcoholic father in an area rife with poverty and despair. So many people aren't able to escape that kind of environment. Why do you think you were able to get out? I have some survivor's guilt about that, because there are a lot of people I went to school with who did not make it, who ended up in prison, who ended up murdered, especially during the time of the crack cocaine infusion into America. I credit my getting out to my mother, my aunts, my grandmother, all these incredible women who prayed and taught me things and believed in me. Had I not had their examples and their straight-up backbone, their insistence that I make something of myself, I don't know where I'd be. Question. You hit rock bottom before any of this success was within your reach. Can you take us into that moment? It was the early 90s here in Atlanta. I had this dream of being a playwright, and I had written a play called I Know I've Been Changed. It was about child abuse survivors and the power of prayer. I was working as a bill collector, and I had saved $12,000. I spent all my money to put this play up, and it didn't work. I lost it all. After that, I tried again many, many times to produce the play. I would get different jobs between those times, but I'd quit to work on the play, and I'd end up homeless. For 3 months, I lived in a Geo Metro that I was hiding from the repo man. The despair, the suicidal thoughts, the overwhelming feeling of not wanting to live in that kind of moment, that was real. Question. And yet you never gave up, and the play succeeded. Answer. That never give up thing came from my mother and my aunts and the ministers and preachers in my family. I can trace the preachers back to slavery. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was a minister. That faith is in my DNA. How did you get from that moment to this one? The seed was planted when I was 9 or 10 years old. My father was a subcontractor. He came home one day and was happy because he had made $800 building a house. But he told me that the white man who owned the house later sold it for $80,000. That didn't make sense to me. I wanted to be the owner of the house. Question. You're a big proponent of ownership, especially of your intellectual property. How did you maintain that ownership once you started working in Hollywood? I was able to make some incredible deals by allowing people to underestimate me. I always played it small, listened to what they had to say, and made the deal. I'd say, well, I've got to own it. They'd say, oh, okay, whatever. They didn't think that my first film, which was 2005's Diary of a Mad Black Woman, which debuted at number one, was going to amount to much. But that support I had from the audience that knew me, those voices, those standing ovations, gave me the confidence to understand that it's a blessing to be hidden. And now you employ many people. Thousands of people come through the gate every day to work here. And it's a beautiful thing. A lot of them are former prisoners who wouldn't have had this shot. Your studio is housed in a historic location. Can you tell me about that? The land itself was once a Confederate Army base, which meant there were people here fighting to keep my ancestors enslaved. From the moment I walked onto the property, I was haunted by it. Sometimes when I'm walking here at night, I get a chill from all the things that have happened here. So as we built each of the 12 sound stages, we buried Bibles underneath them as a way of refocusing the spirit of that place. I wanted this to be a place where everyone was welcome. You have given a lot of Black actors a chance or second chance. Your roster includes Taraji P. Henson, Viola Davis, Idris Elba, and then there's Cicely Tyson. I've never said this publicly, but I took care of Miss Tyson for the last 15 years of her life. She was a proud woman, and the only reason I mention this is because she wrote it in her book. The woman had done so many amazing things, but she wasn't well compensated for it. She made $6,000 for Sounder, you know? I wanted to make sure she knew that there were people who valued her. So she did one day of work on my 2007 film, Why Did I Get Married? I paid her $1 million. I loved working with her, and it makes me feel great that I was in a position to give this incredible woman some security in her latter years. Oprah Winfrey is godmother to your son, and she was your business partner during your collaboration on the Oprah Winfrey Network. When she was struggling with her network, I said, I can help you. Finally, she said, let's see what you can do. I brought scripted material to the network with the crime drama series, The Haves and the Have-Nots. It ran for 8 seasons and is still the highest rated show that was ever on the channel. For Oprah and me, it was important to show Black people that you can work together, that powers can come together and be successful. Question. Every time I talk to a Black man who has a son, I ask, how do you protect your child? What do you teach your child about becoming a man? Tyler's answer. I haven't had the conversation with Amon because he's only 7, and I want to hold out as long as I can. I don't want to tell him that there are people who will judge him because of the color of his skin, because right now he's in a school with every race, and all these kids are in their purest form. When he describes his friends, he never defines them by race. So, the moment he loses that innocence is going to be a very, very sad day for me. I know it's coming, though, because he's already asking some really tough questions. What I want him to be, more than anything, is somebody who sees injustice, speaks out against it, and affects change. Your mother, Maxine, passed away in 2009. You told stories about the way she and her girlfriends would talk when they got together, and the way humor was a kind of anesthetic for her pain. Yeah. I'd watch them play cards on Friday nights. There would be so much laughter in the room. I didn't know it at that time, but I was in a comedy masterclass watching all of those women. Tell me about forgiving your father, whom you support but don't spend time with. Well, what helped me get to a place where I could forgive him for all the abuses is that I found his life story. It made me understand that we all arrive at a place from somewhere. His childhood was full of abuse. I had an opportunity to either carry that on to another generation or dig it up and cut it at its root. The thing that allows you to get to the root, to really get down in there to pull that up, that's forgiveness. You are very private about your personal relationships. Why? Because these people are not famous. My son's not famous. I want him to have as normal a life as he can. I want him to know what it's like to have his own name and his own life and not have the pressure of trying to live up to whatever or whoever your father was. What advice do you have for people who have a dream like yours? Listen, I would love to say, follow my example, but I would never do that. There are no guarantees. You can be as talented as you want to be, and if things don't line up, it's never going to happen. There are many people way more talented than I am who didn't make it. I had some grace and some favor from God. I didn't do it all. I just did the work. But I had no other choice than to follow my dream. I had no other strategy. I had one thing, and that was that first play. It had to work. I wasn't going to write another play if that one didn't work. So I had to wait and hope and pray for that to happen. For me, humility stays very present because I remember living in that car. You know, I don't care if I'm on the plane at 40,000 feet in the air. I still remember those moments. And also, I understand that if something goes wrong at that 40,000 feet, ain't nobody going to help me but God. So, who is Tyler Perry today? I'm Maxine's baby. I'm defined by everything she put in me. She was the kind of woman who tolerated or accepted nothing but your best. And I'm Aman's father. All of this other stuff is really great, but the thing that gives me motivation every day is being Aman's father. The second cover story is called How Halle Berry Found Her Groove. The actress director has had career success and family fulfillment, but never at the same time until now. And this is written by Natasha Stoyanov of ARP. Question. You seem to live your life so purposefully these days, committing to strong projects, to your health, to your family, and to love. Has something shifted in your outlook? Hallie's answer. I had a huge life-changing moment in 2017 in India during a four-hour group meditation with a shaman on a beach. I saw his aura, and the shaman told me I would see things more clearly going forward and would need to react and act. And he was right. When I got back to LA, one of the very first things I did was fire my agent, who kept pitching me the same things over and over. But now I saw it differently. I said, no, I don't belong here anymore. The very first project my new agent gave me was called Bruised. And this project, in turn, on so many levels, changed my life. It empowered me. Sometimes we know something or see something or feel something, and we talk ourselves out of it. I no longer can do that. There are also a ton of personal things that I suddenly saw clearly and thought, nope. That's how I live today. All the goodness I have in my life now is because of that moment in India, because I started to take control of my life in a different way. How did you come to both direct and star in Bruised? Well, directors I respected told me, for your directorial debut, let it be something you love and something you know about. From the moment I read the script, it was a part of me. I was aching to tell it. And this story was a world I knew, domestic violence, for one thing. Not only have I worked with a shelter for 25 years, but it's how I grew up as a young child, with an alcoholic, violent father. As a kid, I saw my mother beaten up, and I know the horror and helplessness a kid feels. I remember my mother feeling humiliated by what her children had to witness. I'm sure parts of what are in my subconscious and in my memory, even these decades later, kind come out through me in this film. While some people might watch it and think, that's harsh, it felt normal to me, which is how I knew it was true. And I knew that I had to go toward the truth and not be afraid of putting this light in these dark places because so many suffer from domestic violence. How do you view your own mom now after your early childhood brushes with abuse and violence? My mother is one of the strongest women I know. My mom's white, my dad was black, and in the 60s and early 70s, she was raising two little black kids after my dad left, and she was alone and a single mom. Parts of her family disowned her. The black side of our family didn't want anything to do with her. I watched her struggle, be strong, face adversity, persevere, never quit, keep going. Sometimes it isn't what she said, but what she did. And I know that's where I get my perseverance from. And I know as a mother myself that I can tell my children anything, but they're watching what I'm doing, and that's what they remember. And yes, you always realize that our parents weren't perfect, that they made mistakes along the way. And then as you get older, because we become parents and we start making mistakes, we start to have grace for them. And we realize they did the best they could at the time. Question: what's up with all these physically demanding roles? X-Men, John Wick, now Bruised. These seem to take on a whole new level. Kicking, punching, and pushing myself to my limits has always been a great, healthy release. Like men, women have a lot of pent-up anger and angst and sadness. I needed a healthy way to get this stuff out of my body. Sweating and working out is fuel for me. I'm also addicted to those good feel endorphins. Sometimes you gotta hit some silly stuff. Playing Jackie Justice was daunting. How could I make people believe I'm a world-class fighter? I wanted to be as realistic as possible, and it wasn't easy. I loved the sport and was a gymnast as a kid, but I had to put in all the work and all the hours, all the training. I never felt like I had enough, and I was always searching for another half hour to learn something new. I also wanted to do the sport justice. I wanted to be the other half of a really good fight. Valentina Shevchenko, who plays the opponent in the final fight in Bruised, is a beast. She really is the reigning MMA champion. I had to look formidable against her. I broke two ribs shooting the big fight you see at the end of the film. We shot that early, so I had to use my stunt double for one of the other fight scenes. But for the most part, it was all me. The movie's point of view is very female. How did you manage that? Taking a woman's point of view was very intentional. I was determined to not just hire as many women as I could, but to also make sure that the story stayed very female and was told from a specific female point of view, that we talked about things that are very feminine. We went to dark places because that's what women do. That's our sensibility. I also wanted an all-female soundtrack and female composer so that the sound of this film that supported these characters in this world would be female. And I hired a female production designer to create the look and feel of all these spaces. I knew that that would matter. No black woman has won a Best Actor Oscar since you did for Monsters Ball 20 years ago. Has there been progress towards representation and equity? Definitely. When I won the Oscar 20 years ago, I didn't see nearly as many faces of color in TV and film as I do now. There's been a 100% change. So while no other black woman stands next to me with a Best Actress Oscar, and it's heartbreaking and I wish there were more, I also know that moment at the Oscars was inspiring and made people believe that anything was possible. Today, you've got Ava DuVernay, Lena Waithe, Viola Davis. I can go on and on. Women of color are doing things, and you know what? They're doing things on their own terms, in their way. They're daring to say, I deserve this. And I say to them, everybody loves an award. We all love when our industry says, you did a great job. But most people will never win an Academy Award or an Olympic gold medal or an MMA championship belt. That doesn't mean the fight's not worth it. It doesn't mean you're not winning. You're working in ways you'd never dreamed of before and on projects that are reflective of you and your culture or your gender. That Academy Award, as precious as it is, didn't change my career. The script truck didn't back up to my house a week after I won. For the last 20 years, I've still had to work hard and create my own opportunities. You remain physically stunning, yet you strive in many roles to submerge that. And on your website, Respin, you talk about an eternal beauty that is age-free. What do you want to say to women who worry about getting older? We're all going to get older. Our skin is going to shrivel up and we're going to look different. I see things changing with my face and body, but I've never put all my eggs in that basket. I've always known that beauty is deeper than the physical body you're walking around in. That's going to fade, and I refuse to become someone who just tries to hold on to a youthful face and not embrace what's most important about being beautiful, how you live your life, how you give back to others, how you connect to people, how you strengthen your mind, body, and soul and nourish yourself, how you give in a meaningful way of yourself. The most beautiful people have something radiating inside. Women are told that when we reach a certain number, we're no longer valuable. I believe the opposite. Society should look at us as jewels as we get older, because the older women get, the more formidable we are. Our next article comes from the entertainment section of ARP, and this article is entitled Book Preview, Jann, J-A-N-N, Wenner's Rock and Roll Memoir. The founder and longtime editor of Rolling Stone magazine shares stories about Mick, Bono, Bruce, and other legends. Mr. Wenner reflects on Annie Leibovitz. Annie Leibovitz would barrel into the office 6 feet tall, wild hair, still in her early 20s, with the energy and enthusiasm to do anything we asked. She had been a painting major and bought her first camera 2 years earlier. A military brat, she was the third of six children, her father a career Air Force officer, her mom a dance instructor. No one could have imagined the light within. Her first cover shoot for Rolling Stone in 1970 was Grace Slick. The insight portrait of Grace and Paul Kantner in bed, playing with their new baby China, foreshadowed Annie's trademark repertorial style, finding a casual personal moment that had the power of unexpected intimacy. Another thing Annie brought us was the emergence of a feminine energy and point of view in what was an all-male shop. Then she had a rookie home run with John Lennon. She begged for the chance to shoot him and Yoko and agreed that I would own the negatives. Deal. When I met her at the San Francisco airport, she was carrying 100 pounds of equipment. She turned down my offer to help. Yoko told her that she and John were so impressed that I had let someone like her, she was still in school, shoot them. They were used to the most famous photographers in the world. It was just one frame. I saw it immediately. John is thinking, it's very private. There is no mask. It's a mystery. She had been using one of her cameras to take a light meter reading. He gave her a quick look, and in that moment, she snapped the shutter for the aperture test. It was an accident, a simple twist of fate. She eventually developed a feel for covers and the special sauce that made a premeditated image simple and compelling. She would shoot 142 covers as chief photographer for Rolling Stone. The next celebrity that Wenner talks about is Bill Clinton. Clinton was incredibly knowledgeable about the complexities of policy making. I loved his language about not being able to get stuff done lickety-split, or that defense cuts were making Europe nervous as a cat. My job was to take the measure of a man emotionally and morally. His response? All the old rules are still the ones that count. I feel better every night when I go home if I have done what I think is right. As Clinton was on his way out, our national affairs editor, Bill Greider, asked one more question. He said a guy who had some minor role in the Clinton campaign had called him that morning. He was now very disappointed and told Greider he should ask Clinton what he's willing to stand up for and die on. Suddenly, the president was 1 foot from Grider, his face red and his voice rising in a furious rebuke. I have fought more damn battles here for more things than any president in 20 years and not gotten one damn bit of credit from the liberal knee-jerk press, and I'm sick and tired of it, and you can put that in your damn article. I have fought and fought and fought and fought. I get up here every day and I work till late at night on everything from national security to family leave to the budget to the crime bill. If you convince them I don't have any conviction, that's fine, but it's a damn lie. It's a lie. Clinton started to walk away. I was speechless. Grider didn't flinch. Clinton turned back to him, still mad as hell. That's why they always win. This administration is killing itself every day. You hold us to an impossible standard and never give us any credit when we are moving forward. We have fought our guts out for them, and the bad guys win because they have no objective other than to win. Mr. Winter talks now about Bruce Springsteen. Down in Jersey, one late afternoon, we were having drinks around the outdoor fire with Patty and Bruce, who was throwing me some shade about not having gone on his European tour that summer. Why didn't Matt and I come see him in Brazil in a few weeks? When we got to the hotel in Sao Paulo, Bruce's manager, John Landau, was waiting for us. The show that night was an hour across Sao Paulo at a campus gymnasium. Bruce was a giant international star, but not in Latin America. The next day we went to Rio and checked into the Copacabana Hotel. It was a day off, so Bruce took us to a prettier, less crowded beach. We bought a lot of drinks and freshly opened coconuts and emptied a few bottles of tanning oil. Bruce was in great shape. He said one night on stage a few months earlier, he looked up at his screen projection and saw that fat Elvis. Now he was buff, wearing tight t-shirts. We had been followed by some paparazzi who shot Bruce and me walking on the beach. By the time we picked up our towels and went for lunch, there was a message from the office. They emailed pictures of us on the beach, which had just been sent from a photo agency. Obviously, I hadn't had any warning to suck up the gut. I showed Bruce, who said, "You can't go anywhere these days. The minute you go anywhere, you are everywhere." And our final segment today comes from the entertainment section, and it's called These Playlists Are Just What Your Day Needs. So if you want to have a great day, you can head to the playlist on Spotify called Have a Great Day. And the tunes are like sunny, singable hits, including favorites from Stevie Nicks, Stevie Wonders, and dozens of other artists. And you should listen when you're feeling good about life or need a pick-me-up. Another one is called Confidence Boost. That's the title that you search for on Spotify. The set is called Confidence Boost. And this is like tunes from Leslie Gore, You Don't Own Me, Destiny's Child, Aretha Franklin. And this you listen to when life's got you down. Another one on Spotify that you do a search for is called Beer and Wings. The tunes are fist-pumping tracks from the likes of Green Day, Miley Cyrus, Aerosmith. And this you listen to when you're prepping for game day. And another one on Spotify is called Stay in Bed. And this compilation of tunes is snuggly songs from like Sam Cooke, Etta James, and a group called Fleet Foxes. And you listen to this when you're having just that lazy, lazy Sunday. And our last one is called Take In My Beer. And this can be found on Amazon Music. And this is a compilation of tunes from people like Carrie Underwood, Chris Stapleton, and Casey Musgraves. And this is you listen to when you need some music to pair with that box of tissues. And you have been listening to ARP Magazine on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thanks for listening. And you can hear this again at 9 p.m. this evening. This is Kevin Altamirano saying goodbye from Owl Radio.